that C.S. Lewis wrote. The book is called Mere Christianity, and it doesn't go into a whole lot of detail about all the Christian doctrines, but it just kind of gives us an overview of a lot of Christian doctrines and essentially what makes Christianity better than any alternative. So it's a very encouraging book. This is one of my copies. This is actually a whole bunch of books, about six books in one, and Mere Christianity is about this much of it. So if you haven't read it, I was very encouraged by it. It's one of the books that I would highly recommend. And, I don't agree with everything that Lewis says or taught. I probably don't agree with everything anybody teaches except, what's in the Bible, and then I don't understand a lot of that. But, he just gives you a different way of thinking about some things, a good way of thinking about a lot of things. Today we're going to talk about Christian marriage. Uh-oh. There we go. Christian marriage. I lost my connection here. Lewis, he says right at the beginning of this chapter that he didn't really want to talk about marriage because, one, he never married. He was a bachelor all his life. And two, he said because the Christian view of marriage was very unpopular. Okay, he wrote this book in 1952, and it's based on a series of talks that he gave in 1943. Okay, so even then, the Christian view of marriage was very unpopular. So this is not a new thing. Satan's been attacking attacking marriage since the days of Adam and Eve. Okay, so this is just a continuing effort here to undermine it. Well, I keep losing my connection here, so I can't see what you're seeing back there. Okay, first, husband and wife are a single organism. Christianity, we know that man and wife, God made man and woman to be married, and in that union they become one flesh. This is not just a sentiment, okay? This is a statement of fact. So man and woman work together as one organism. Actually, it's sort of like a lock and a key. Okay, together they work as one machine. One isn't much good without the other. Also, another way you might think about it is a violin and a bow. Together they make one instrument. Apart, what are they? Okay, so God made man and woman to be united. And one example, a great example here is Ephesians chapter 5, 25 through 33. Let's turn there and read that. Actually, if someone would read that, Ephesians 5, 25 through 33, if you get there, start reading. 5. All right, so here we have that language, two shall become one flesh. There's that idea. And what does that mean, one flesh? And if you look back at verse 28, in the same way husbands should love their wives as their own bodies, he who loves his wife loves himself. Okay, so there's that, we can see the union in that language there. Now, just a few verses above, starting in verse 22, it says, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. I think that's one of the ways in today's society where Christian marriage is very unpopular. With is it called second phase feminism? I think that submitting to a man is very unpopular these days. But look at what Paul commands husbands to do. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. What does that mean? I didn't really understand that until we were about 20 years into marriage. What does it mean that a husband should love his wife as Christ loved the church? I want some thoughts. Right. So he gave his life for the church. He gave his life. The church is the bride of Christ. So did Christ love the church like he loved himself? As much as he loved himself? Looks to me like he loved the church more than he loved himself. All right. Comparing that to verse 22, wives, submit to your husbands. Isn't this a form of submission to be able to sacrifice yourself so that somebody else can have what they need? I think that's something that a lot of young husbands need to learn, that the husbands has a lot of responsibility. Being the head of the household is not just a title, okay? It comes with a lot of a responsibility, and there's a lot of weight to that. Let's see. But this idea that the two shall become one flesh, I think in the secular view of marriage, is more like a business relationship that can be dissolved whenever it becomes too complicated, or whenever the two aren't getting along. When it's not just working out anymore, you know, then we can call it quits. We can break the contract. That's not the view of the Christian view of marriage. But the Christian view of marriage, divorce is more like an amputation of a limb. It's like removing body parts, because when you get married, God does something that maybe can't be seen, but it's still just as real. He creates that union, and severing that union is a big deal. So the natural consequence is that divorce is like dissecting a living organism. Let's look at Malachi chapter 2, verses 13 through 16. Malachi 2, 13 through 16. Go ahead and start reading if you find it.
Thank you. life is not covered. And he did not be made one. Yet had he the residue of the Spirit, and wherefore one, that he might see the godly seed. Therefore take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously against the life of his seed. For the Lord, the God of Israel, said that he ain't putting away. For one covered violence with his garment, said the Lord of hosts, therefore take heed to your spirit, that you deal not treacherously.
All right. The ESV in verse 16 says, for the man who does not love his wife but divorces her, says the Lord God of Israel, covers his garment with violence, says the Lord of hosts. So guard yourselves in your spirit and do not be faithless. So in the days of Malachi, they had taken this view that divorce is just that marriage is just a convenience and it can be, you know, done away with, you know, at a whim. That was not God's intent. He says here, when you made that promise, you may have forgotten your promise, but God didn't forget your promise. Okay? God remembered that oath that you took when you married your wife. So that's God's view on marriage. Any comments on that section? All right. Let's see. Again, the modern view of marriage. Divorce is just a simple readjustment of partners. This is completely foreign to what God had in mind. And, you know, it's Lewis kind of goes into some reasons maybe why somebody might go into marriage with the idea that they don't intend to fulfill their vow. If you get married in a church, you take an oath, right, to be married till death do you part. Do you take that vow seriously? I wonder if some do or some don't. Lewis says, to this, someone may reply that he regarded the promise made in church as a mere formality and never intended to keep it. Okay, whom then is he trying to deceive when he made it? Is he trying to deceive God? That would be very unwise. Is he trying to deceive himself? Why would you do that? That's also unwise. Is the bride trying to deceive the bridegroom, or the bridegroom trying to deceive the bride? Well, that's just downright despicable. That's wicked. Or maybe they're trying to deceive everybody else, just trying to deceive the public. They want the respectability that's attached to marriage without intending to pay the price for that, without trying to remain faithful. So, you know, that means that they were imposters. They cheated, okay, when they took that vow. So taking that vow is serious. And, you know, we may forget our vows, but God doesn't forget our vows. And he goes, let's see, that's on the next slide too. Who is someone trying to deceive when they go into marriage without taking it seriously? And this is one of the views that I'm not real sure of that C.S. points out. So if you're not going to take that vow seriously, why get married in the first place? Here Lewis writes, if people do not believe in permanent marriage, it's perhaps better that they should live together unmarried than that they should make vows that they do not mean to keep. It's true that by living together without marriage, they will be guilty and Christianized of fornication. But one fault is not mended by adding another. Unchastity is not improved by adding perjury. Essentially, you don't fix one sin by adding another sin on top of it, is what he's saying. And I'd have to think about that a little bit. But this is the view that many millennials have adopted today. I've overheard co-workers. I've talked to some of my younger friends, and this is the view that they have. They've looked at their parents' marriages and divorces, and they think, what's the point? You know, why do this in at all? You know, so what we see is that many in the younger generations just deciding to live together. Okay, they're not even bothering to make that commitment because they know it won't last, because they haven't been taught any better. And you know, shacking up is fornication. But Christianity is out of vogue these days. That's just the facts. So why do they care what Christians think anyway? But that's the state of marriage in the United States today, and it's sad. It's heartbreaking, I think. Any comments? Yeah, Ryan. Yeah, try it out. Yeah, and that I think it may have started earlier, but I started noticing that in the 80s. Yeah, and today it's I think it's even more commonplace. And I wonder if people even have marriage in mind when they start living together. Yeah. Right. It really is. Yeah, it's unfortunate that with the kids that my kids go to school with, Paula and I are a rarity. Not having stepmoms and stepdads, it's not common. It's not the norm anymore. This is something we touched on just a little bit last week, is this idea of love. We read in Ephesians 5 where husbands are commanded to love your wives. Okay, so being in love, all right, that's the feeling you have. Being in love is, if being in love is the only reason for marriage, then that promise that you make, it adds nothing to it, okay? But making that promise, it comes out of that feeling of love, okay? The promise that is made when I'm in love, and because I'm in love, that promise to be true to the beloved as long as I live, that commits me to being true even if I fall out of love, even if I'm no longer in love. Okay? So, love and in love, two different things. Being in love is a feeling and it can pass. I think, let's see. Oh, I'm getting ahead of myself. But here, this last point, falling out of love. Okay, that's not a valid reason for breaking a promise. Okay, to break that vow, just because you don't have that feeling anymore, that's not good enough. But because the promise that you made while you were in love, it's still in effect when you fall out of love. That's what Malachi was getting at in the verse that we read earlier. But let's see. All right. So I think most of us have been in love. All right. A lot of us have been in love. It's a great feeling. We like that feeling. But, you know, in our society, I think we've been trained to think along the lines of good and bad and not good, better, and best. Okay. But being in love, all right, that's good. Okay. But loving, well, that's even better. Okay. It doesn't feel as intense. But being, but loving, the love will carry us through. Being in love is, you know, love is, here we go, feelings don't last. We don't expect, like we don't expect the taste of chocolate to last. Okay? We take a bite of chocolate and it tastes so good. But how long does it last? Just for a moment. And then it fades. But that's what being in love is like. It's like that taste of chocolate. But with chocolate, we don't expect it to last all day or all week or for the rest of our lives, okay? So why do we expect this feeling of being in love to be as intense or to last through the rest of our life? Love, however, is sustainable because it's not a feeling. It's something that you do. It's something that you decide to do, okay? And it takes will, and it takes commitment. And it's actually something that we are commanded to do, okay? Ephesians 5, husbands are commanded to love their wives. Well, what if I'm not in love with my wife anymore? Well, God says, love your wife, okay? Well, what if I don't like her? What if she burned the bacon, all right? What if she doesn't make me cookies anymore because I gained, 30 pounds, you know? Well, God still says, love your wife, okay? God says, love your neighbor. Well, what if my neighbor's a scoundrel? Well, God says, love your neighbor, okay? You don't have to like somebody to love them, but that love will carry you through, And this is, I think, one of my favorite comments in this section. Lewis says that love is the great conqueror of lust. The great conqueror of lust. All right. What if my wife has gained, 30 pounds over the last, 20 years? You know, what if I've put some gray hairs on her head? You know, and then some nice young lady. Just got hired at work, and she's good looking, she's nice. Being in love doesn't help me out there, but love, my love for my wife, the person that I've committed to and vowed and taken that vow for, that will keep me honest, all right? Keep me from doing things I should not do. So, being in love, again, a feeling. And here's another good one. Now, no feeling can be relied on to last its full intensity or even to last at all. Knowledge can last. Principles can last. Habits can last. But feelings come and go. And that's where love needs to become a habit for us. Let me see. Oh yeah, and here's another good one. This love, in the second sense, love is distinct from being in love. It's not merely a feeling; it's a deep unity maintained by the will and deliberately strengthened by habit, reinforced by the grace which both partners ask and receive from God. They can have this love for each other, even at those moments when they don't like each other. And I think if you've been married for very long, there have been times when you just don't like your partner. But love can carry you through that. Like love is the engine of marriage, okay? It keeps it going. And being in love was the explosion that starts it, okay? So that being in love kicked it off. Being in love caused us to make that commitment. And love allows us to fulfill that commitment. Yes. Yeah, I think it gets easier. When it becomes a habit, just like any sport. I used to run. I don't run too much now, but you know, it's when you do it as you know habitually and regularly, it gets easier. When you slack off, then it doesn't. Hard habits have to be easy. Good habits have to be maintained. Bad habits are easy. But, yeah, Larry.
First of all, I'm not going to say that I want to help you do it. But I think where the Christian has maybe a little better or easier goal is that both husband and wife are Christian, and they are not only devoted to each other, but devoted to God.
Yeah, I. Right, I agree. I think it does help us a lot. If we hadn't been Christians, Paula and I might have called it quits, a while back. But our commitment to God and our kids, and and knowing that we were accountable for those vows that we took, that made us work it out. Made us to commit to love. And I think we can't talk about love without talking about 1 Corinthians 13. Let's turn there. 1 Corinthians 13, verses 4 through 8. And you read passages like this in Ephesians chapter 5, 23 and following, and you see that the love that God talks about is so much different than the love that we talk about in our songs, on movies and in books. It's completely different. But let's look at the love in 1 Corinthians 13. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. As for prophecies, they will pass away. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will pass away. But love is patient and kind. And the key to a good marriage is to marry a patient and kind woman. if Paula hadn't been that, then it would have been all over. We would have been doomed from the start. But she was so patient with me, and I'm glad she was. But being patient and kind, it's not arrogant or rude. You know, if we can remember that, that helps a lot. Does not insist on its own way. All right? So, you know, being the head of the house doesn't mean being the boss. Okay? It's a partnership. I mean, you're one machine. You're one body. So, you know, you have to collaborate. What you do has to work for your spouse. Bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things. We have to assume the best, all right? And when somebody does something wrong, does something you don't like, is it just a matter of personal differences, you know? Or is it something serious? That's you have to think about that before you insist on your own way, I think. And believes all things. I think that means that you assume the best in others. I like the language of the King James. It's
sometimes it's hard to understand.
It can be, yeah.
But sometimes I really enjoy the words. Some of the words they use are just more in depth.
Yeah, there's an elegance to it.
The word charity there, I think, like.
Yeah. But you know, associating charity with you know, husbands, love your wives. It's the same word. It's, you know, same. Well, it's the same root. We have to. That's a good point. Any other comments on love and being in love? All right. Here's another. This may be a little controversial. How far should Christians go in forcing our view of marriage on society? And here's what? But traditionally, the United States is a Christian society. That's starting to. Well, the U.S. is becoming more and more secular as the years go by. How far should we go as far as enacting and enforcing and encouraging laws that maintain the Christian standard of marriage? Personally, I kind of think it'd be a good idea to encourage that as much as we can. To elect people who will do that. But then think again. C.S. Lewis gave us an example that he would not want Muslims to impose their religious rules on us. If a lot of Muslim representatives got into power and started enacting laws, would we want them to enforce their rules, a lot of their rules on us? But this is also something that been touched on last week. Lewis thinks that there should be a basic definition of marriage on the civil level, but as far as church goes, we should have probably a different understanding of marriage. That may be what we're going to be going to.
Mm-hmm. I think the Babylonians, I think it says, had a concept of two.
Oh, really?
I think the one that we have nowadays kind of stems from the Roman Empire. And I think there is a difference between the concept of matrimony, kind of a state civil agreement with the partners, and then something that is a marriage that is between two people in the presence of God.
Yeah.
I think that kind of goes all the way back to the root form of, I think that the whole intent of it is to come together with the intention of showing charity to one another the rest of the life.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're seeing a lot of big changes today. Marriage was generally governed by the states until just a few years ago, and now the federal government got involved, and now anything goes, pretty much. So I think we're going to start seeing that marriage, in view of the civil government, is something very different than marriage from the perspective of the church. And I think, just like everything else, we have to hold ourselves to a higher standard. And we're going to see that more and more. I think that leading by example is one of the best things that we can do. We're called upon to be a light in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation. I think that's in Philippians. But I think that is so important for so that people can look to us and see that, hey, what do they have that I don't? And maybe we can lead them to Christ in that way. Not try to shove it down their throat. That's not going to work, is it? But just try to lead by example. Be that, again, that the light along the shore. Just, you know, whatever glimmer that we can, glimmer of hope that we can show other people, that's what we need to do. Well, that's all I have. Any other comments? We have just a couple more minutes. All right. Well, thank you for your input.